Welcome to another episode of Photo Geek Weekly. This is episode 28 for May 31st, 2018. And I am joined this week to talk about all manner of interesting camera hardware, software, the industry in general, with my favorite man from Slovenia, Joseph Lenaschke.
Not in Slovenia right now, but hey, it was a good place to be for a couple of weeks. How you doing, Don?
Exactly. I'm doing great. How about yourself?
Very well. Very well indeed. Trying to stay warm. It suddenly got cold again here in Oregon. I'm not quite sure why.
I mean, you've got, is it like an El Nino year or something where the weather in the Pacific goes?
It's just, it's Oregon. And so it's like, hey, it's warm. Just kidding. It's cold. Just kidding. It's warm.
Well, I'm kind of envious, actually. It's been, you know, in the 30s in Celsius, that's 90 plus here, which is about as warm as it gets in this area. And our air conditioner is both too old and too small for this house.
Yeah.
So, hey, I guess we could complain no matter which way we go. But it's been good for the gardens. I've been out shooting and enjoying what I can find out there. For those that don't know, we've got award-winning perennial gardens here. And just today, I took it upon myself to install my first IoT device, which is an irrigation controller. Because the original one was very poorly designed and cost me $600 the first time that I used it in my water bill. So let's hope that doesn't happen again.
Scary.
Yeah, exactly. You know, just nature and just the love of photography on a macro scale has been keeping me impassioned in the last little while. And so how about you? What's new and exciting with you?
Oh, just working away over here, building up the YouTube channel. That's still going real well over at youtube.com/photojoseph. And the big thing that I've got coming up actually is a workshop in India, which is next year. January 30th to February 9th, I think it is, in 2019. And all of the information on that is at photojoseph.com/India.
Now, what is there to shoot in India?
There's nothing there.
Actually, we'll stumble across something, but...
Yeah, we'll stumble across a thing or two. No, we're going to three cities, but the main center point of the trip is this thing called the Kumbh Mela, which is this event that the main one happens every 12 years, and then every... other 12 years, so every sixth year, there is a half mela, which is what we're going to see. And it is one of, if not the largest gatherings of human beings on the planet. The half mela that we'll be there for is expecting around 60 million people to go through this city over the course of about a month to a month and a half, I think it is. The full mela actually sees about 120 million people. So, you know, we're there for the small one. And that is part of what we're going to see. And it's one of those where you have different religious groups coming together, bathing in the river, doing various religious events. It's just this huge, huge gathering of humanity. And it's one of those spectacles that you can only see in a place like that and hopefully get some good photography out of.
And it seems like the kind of thing that it's a twofold experience. The photographic experience and documenting those little snapshots, that's really what allures people. But they'll walk away, I'm sure, from the experience itself, being there and being a part of it, almost more valuable than the photography.
Yeah.
In my experience, when you go well outside of your norm, it has such an impact on you. I spent time in the Yukon wilderness as a complete opposite, where you're in desolate isolation, and the brilliance of nature untouched by humanity was just such a wonderful, serene, peaceful thing for me to take away. And if I had gotten home and all of my memory cards were corrupted or lost or whatever, I'd still be a better person for going on that trip. And exactly the opposite, a gathering of humanity to such a degree with peaceful celebration and at least hopefully it stays peaceful. Mm-hmm. You get that many people in a room together, you never know what's going to happen. Regardless, it would be an experience that even if you're not a photographer, would be a worthwhile one to write about or to just affect your life for the time going on.
Yeah, no doubt. No doubt about it. It's going to be a spectacular. That is for sure. So,
yeah, have you been there before?
I have been to India a few times. Certainly not to Kumbh Mela before. That's going to be new to me. But I have been. I haven't been to everywhere that we're going. But assuming that the trip happens, we only need four people for the workshop to be a go and maximum of eight. So it's going to be quite a small gathering. Assuming that it's a go, then I will be traveling out there in November to do a scouting trip. There's a company out there that's organizing all the on-the-ground logistics for me, and they will take me around all the places we'll go and some other ones in anticipation of potential future workshops. So,
Yeah, that's one of the big challenges too, especially in a location or at an event that you couldn't really pre-visit unless you did it, you know, 12 years ago.
Right, exactly.
That you don't really know what you're getting yourself into. Even if when you go to the specific locations, there are going to be surprises that hopefully the organizers that have done this before will be able to make you aware of.
Yep.
I might be doing an Iceland tour next year. Okay. But I'm just being hired by, like as a photographic instructor for people that want to go on the tour. So I have a hands off for all of the organization and planning and direction of that. I just get to tag along and show people how to use their cameras, which for me, I would prefer that because I've never been to Iceland before. Mm-hmm. You know, otherwise I would definitely want to do a scouting trip myself to make sure that everything is buttoned down just like you're planning on doing.
Well, connect me to that company, if you will. I love that idea of not having to do all the back end work because there's a lot of work that goes into planning a workshop like this.
Yeah, you know, it's probably less profitable than having my my teeth sunk more deeply into it.
Sure.
But it's much less stressful, especially if it's my first time going to a specific location. I'm sure I can put you in touch.
Absolutely. Well, hopefully some of your listeners will be interested and just head to photojoseph.com/India and all the information is there.
Heck, I'm interested. If I could get away for that amount of time, then I might even consider it. But
that's like 10 days. You can do it. Call it 2 weeks with travel.
Yeah, but you know, with me and my wife working full time with a 2-year-old daughter at home, just timing is really tight right now.
I understand.
But hey, maybe in the future.
There you go.
If this is a success for you, I'm going to keep my eye on your workshop listings.
Awesome.
And I know how much effort it takes to plan this sort of stuff. I've got stuff coming up all across North America throughout the year. And, you know, the NECCC is the next big one that's coming up in July. There's one in Toronto, June 21st and 22nd as well. I'm in, Princeton, New Jersey for an infrared photography workshop.
Ooh, that's cool.
Yeah, I didn't think that there'd be enough interest to do one for the last few years, so I just held off, but it's almost filled up. So,
awesome.
Yeah, but workshops and education, I think that's where a lot of photographers go for their inspiration these days, rather than just trying to find it online, because the internet can be an unkind place, at least an unproductive place for photographic growth, if you're just going to the forums and the social media places. The biggest insult is nobody posting a comment because it means everybody, you know, I guess the famous rule, you know, you don't have anything nice to say, you just pass it by and you don't make any comment whatsoever. It's kind of fun to see that when I post some images that are well off the beaten path that appeal to me, but maybe not everybody else. And I hear crickets. Okay, that's fine.
Yeah, that's a whole show topic unto itself. How much value do you put into the comments or lack thereof or likes or the lack thereof for your photos? And, you know, I would argue that some of the best photography isn't the kind of stuff that most people like. It's not the kind of thing that's going to get a million likes on Facebook. You know, pretty flowers and half-naked women get a million likes on Facebook and Instagram. But if you post something truly compelling and truly thought-provoking that is a perhaps more relevant or just really, really significant image, it may not quite get that interaction. And you might feel like, well, this isn't a good photo. No, it is a good photo. It's an important photo. It's
the most popular images that I've posted recently are ultraviolet fluorescence images of flowers.
That's so cool, though.
They are cool, but they are pretty just kind of technician-oriented work. Like, it's documentary work. The artistry is there, but it's kind of a rinse and repeat process from a creative standpoint. Mm. You just put a different flower in front of the lights, you take a picture of it, and, you know, edit to your heart's content, but it's going to be the same thing. And much can be said for my work with snowflakes, but they're still really cool. I like to get a little bit more creative with compositions once in a while. And sometimes the narrative is lost on people, and that's okay, because I had fun doing it.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right, let's take a look at some of the stories that we have on the schedule today. The first one seems minor on the outset, but I think it has some stronger undertones. And this is that Sony has revealed a faster and higher resolution OLED viewfinder display. And this is for OEMs to integrate into whatever products that they deem fit for this. Mm-hmm. And we're talking any Micro Four Thirds or mirrorless camera. And I'm sure a lot of other devices too, if you've got some sort of heads-up display or VR headset, you know, this sort of thing might be applicable in some way, maybe not at the same size. But one of the things that has turned me off a little bit from mirrorless cameras, especially in the early days, was the quality of the electronic viewfinders.
Absolutely.
And I know that they are getting better and better. But they're still not quite at parity in certain scenarios compared to an optical viewfinder, especially in low light where there might be a frame rate delay. And that's not the viewfinder itself. That's just the processing capabilities of the cameras. And that's improving as time goes on as well. But the resolution was something for me that I remember using the Olympus OMD EM1, which was okay. A groundbreaking camera in the day, and I just couldn't love the viewfinder. The LCD screen on the back was fine, and it was just so bad to look through that viewfinder, they might as well have just not included it at all. So now we're getting to the point where the average consumer mirrorless camera will have around 2 million pixels in the viewfinder, but this new one from Sony has a resolution of 16,000 by 12,000 pixels. That's almost 6 million dots of resolution in your viewfinder. And at a full solid frame rate at 120 frames per second, dishing out every single line from that viewfinder. Or if you want to skip lines to get it even faster, they've got a 240 frame per second mode, which I'm not sure is entirely necessary. But this seems like it will improve the usability of just about every next generation flagship mirrorless camera out there. What are your thoughts on how this technology is progressing, Joseph?
Yeah, well, going back to what you're saying about the beginning, the early days, I remember too playing with early mirrorless cameras back at Photokina, gosh, I don't know what, probably a decade ago or so, and just thinking, well, this is ridiculous. This is pointless. If I can't see through the viewfinder, I can't see what's going on, then what is the purpose of this? But of course, as you said, it has evolved greatly. And even today, the Lumix G9, which is, as you know, I'm an ambassador for Panasonic, so I'm always got my hands on the latest and greatest in there. But the Lumix G9, the viewfinder, the electronic viewfinder, does have 120 frame per second refresh rate. And it is incredible. You're looking through that. It is almost like looking through an optical viewfinder. And you talk about things like low light capability. You know, so yeah, if you have electronic viewfinder, you're in low light, it can be harder to see. But now with the ability to actually boost the image, you can see things with an electronic viewfinder today that you can't see with an optical viewfinder.
Oh, especially so if you're trying to composition things at night. I remember having to maybe take a test shot, readjust the composition for the edges of the frame, and taking another test shot, and then, okay, that's great, and I've got to worry about focus. And all of this time is time wasted, whereas if I could see it properly in the viewfinder, then I wouldn't have that same struggle. So yeah, right, there's absolutely benefits. Do you know what the resolution of the EVF in the G9 is?
Not offhand. I'd have to look that up. I don't know offhand, but it's beautiful. I can tell you that much. And one of the things about it is that it has various levels of zoom. So if you're not wearing glasses, eyeglasses, you put your eye right up to it, you can have it at the biggest size. But if you've ever worn glasses or even tried to look through your viewfinder with sunglasses on, you know that your eye, of course, is now farther away from the viewfinder. And you tend to lose the edges of it. And so what the G9 does is it kind of zooms out, if you will, so that you can see the full thing, even if you're wearing eyeglasses, which is huge. There's a lot of really great advantages to electronic over optical these days.
If you were to try and do an optical viewfinder with a sensor that small, it would be so tiny, it would be mostly unusable. Reminds me of like the old Polaroid cameras where the little tiny little pinhole that you would look through to compose the image was completely useless to the end result. I mean, it might show you where the edges of the frame are, but not a whole lot more than that. So having a small sensor, you can actually have a much larger electronic viewfinder than the sensor would normally allow optically, which is another advantage there too.
Now,
some people are saying that the increase in resolution is 1.6 times. I heard some other comparisons saying it's only 25% bigger, but I think that it's pushing through quite a bit. Like if you look at what the A7 III has, it has a 3.7 million dot display in its electronic viewfinder.
I just looked it up. So the G9 is 3.68 million or thousand dots, anyway, 3.7. Right.
So a very
same as the Sony.
Same resolution as the Sony. It might even be the same component. What a lot Could of people be. Don't realize is that Sony makes a heck of a lot of parts for every camera.
Yeah, absolutely.
I remember it was Giga Macro took apart. These are the guys that put together gigapixel macro images with a grid panorama focus stack hardware array. We did an episode of Inside the Lens where we interviewed the founder, and it was pretty fun stuff. But they took apart a Canon Rebel, and lo and behold, the LCD screen on the back of that camera is a Sony product.
Sure.
So no matter which camera you buy, you're probably paying some pennies to Sony based on the components that are in the cameras. So to say that this is a Sony product is a bit of a misnomer, because yes, they're probably going to put it in their own equipment, but this is a free to license for anybody that needs this tech.
Yep, absolutely. And oftentimes what happens, and I don't know when regards to Panasonic specifically, because the companies don't generally talk about this sort of thing, but quite often what happens is a company will license a LCD or something like that from a company like Sony, but it's not just the off the shelf. It has certain customized tweaks that the licensor has requested. And so
especially
they are getting
if they're buying a million
product.
Of them. Yeah.
Well, right. Absolutely. So they are getting a unique product, but it is still made by Sony or whoever else is making it.
Right. In the world of technology, one company cannot produce every single component inside of the device. I know Canon makes their own sensors. I believe Panasonic has some sort of sensor creation capabilities, although it's hard to find any specific details on that. I know they have patents and a portfolio there. But interesting to see where this technology is evolving, because it's really going to quickly usurp the traditional digital SLR market. And I'm still holding on to my 1DX Mark II as a workhorse. But when it comes time to upgrade that camera, I'm probably not going to buy whatever its successor is. It's going to be something much smaller, easier to handle, because the power is completely capable in a small package.
Certainly.
Speaking of those smaller packages, not quite as small as the Micro Four Thirds world, but Fuji has announced the X-T100 camera, and they use an APS-C sensor size, relatively. I can't remember their exact dimensions, if it matches the Canon or the Nikon version, but it has that 1.6 times crop factor or thereabouts. Now, this is a pretty revolutionary camera in terms of what they're packing in for the price, around $600 with no lens, $700 if you need just a kit lens just kind of bundled in there. 24 megapixel camera. It seems to have a fairly capable autofocus system and pretty expandable ISO range. Now, at a price point like this, you know, we look at cameras on the market today and where they're priced relative to performance. You can go, this is sort of the bottom end, $500 to $600 range in the interchangeable lens world. And then you go up to $1,000, the mid-range, and, multiple thousands of dollars is an easy thing to have. And there is a sliding scale in terms of the features that you get when you pay more.
Sure.
So I got to look at the spec list and figure out, okay, where are the corners being cut on a camera like this? And is that useful to certain people? Because most of the cameras that are being marketed today, 4K is a throw-in. I mean, it's in the latest Canon EOS M camera. Even though it's not on any other consumer camera, it's likely to be in all of their future products. And I'm seeing the 4K video here at 15 frames per second. I'm thinking, that's not useful for anybody.
No.
I mean, maybe if you're marketing it as a way to pull out an individual frame at 15 frames per second, but then why don't you have a 15 frames per second shooting mode instead of a continuous rate of shooting only six frames per second.
Six.
Which to me, I mean, I'm spoiled with the flagship Canon camera at 14 frames per second. But there's a lot of cameras that, for much less money, get that same frame rate. So this, to me, I'm looking at these specs and thinking, how much of this is software locked? Because they just need to fit it into a product category at the lower end, where they're just limiting some of the features, where they're buying the processor that's in it in bulk to put in multiple cameras, and then just locking some features out, which then makes me think somebody like Magic Lantern could come along, like they have done with a lot of the Canon cameras, and tweak this and that, and make this camera outperform its more expensive brothers. And then we would see a kind of an uplift of sales for it. But I don't know, if you're buying into a system right now, because whether you're brand new to photography or you just need to shift, if you're shifting from one brand to another, you're probably not going to buy an entry-level product because you already have something better than that in your own portfolio. And if you're buying into a new system, does a camera like this make sense?
Well, it could. I mean, there's a lot of things you've talked about there to unpack here, but as far as the first camera switching systems, I know that when I switched to mirrorless, my first mirrorless camera was not a top end camera. It was a mid range one that I just wanted to play with and see is this really going to fit into my workflow? Do I really like it? And I found myself using it more and more and eventually decided that this was in fact the route that I wanted to go. And so I started buying more and more expensive gear. Mm-hmm. So I think it does make sense in that regard. It's certainly an attractive price point. I mean, you can't argue with the price there. And Fuji does make a good product, and the images that come out of it are always very, very nice. I don't know anything about their autofocus system, so I can't comment on that. But that 15 frame per second 4K video is a little bit weird for sure. Now, you talk about the possibility of it being the same sensor and or processor that is just being software limited. But while that could possibly be true, obviously I have no idea, it could be true. One of the things to realize on a camera like that is processing 4K video at 30 frames per second or 60 frames per second generates a lot of heat, a lot of heat. And this is why one of the reasons, and I can speak to the Lumix gear because I know it, is one of the reasons that the GH5 and these other cameras are bigger, physically bigger when they shoot 4K 60p is because they have a huge heat sink in them. They have to have a way to dissipate all that heat. And if you were to successfully hack a camera like this little Fuji, it would probably overheat and shut down pretty quickly, which is a problem that we saw with some of the early Sony shooting 4K. They'd overheat after just a few minutes and shut down.
Yeah, so there were rumors that the original Canon 1DC that shot 4K video, which was a, and we talked about this in the last episode, an almost identical camera to the original 1DX, Canon had said that they redesigned the internals for better heat dissipation for the 4K video, but they also never released the firmware to the public. If you wanted to update the firmware on your camera, you would have to send it directly to them, probably because the firmware was completely compatible with the 1DX, and people could flash the firmware on that to reveal all of the extra features. So, I mean, firmware updates are an interesting thing to consider for that, whether they're official or unofficial, and they can always add new features. I remember there was a pretty significant update to the 1DX to add new features, and Canon has done that in my experience in the past with that with the 7D had a huge increase in features midway through its lifespan. And I remember when I was using my first real serious camera, the 5D Mark II, there were some significant increases in quality and performance, and even some hardware updates that were available. There was a mode lock, like a mode switch that you could get upgraded to have a locking button on it. And I bought into that upgrade as well. So I'm happy that camera manufacturers are continuously improving their products even after they've pushed them out. And also in the news, and you can really speak to this one, Joseph, because I know you've dug into the language and deciphered it. There has been some updates from Panasonic on their three flagship cameras: the GH5, the GH5S, and the G9. And it's really interesting to see how a company can innovate a product after it ships because of new technology that can be adapted, or just from user feedback to make it a more enjoyable process, or to use the camera like you know it, like the back of your hands, without having to hunt through menus, through new uses of custom function buttons and things like that. So what exactly has Panasonic done here for these three cameras? Are they the same upgrades across the board, or do they differ a little bit?
It's largely the same update. It's some updates apply only to certain cameras, like the G9 has the high resolution mode. None of the other cameras have that. So there are updates to that high res mode that, of course, only apply to that camera.
And the GH5S does not have an in-body image stabilizer, so the improvements there are moot as well.
Right, exactly. Stabilization stuff doesn't apply there and so on. So there are features that don't apply simply because they're not relevant to the hardware. But for the most part, it is a pretty universal upgrade across all three cameras. So the big high point ones are improvements to the autofocus system, both in just general improvements and also what could be considered bug fixes. So that's nice to see. I know that early reports are already out that the improvements are significant. And so the GH5 autofocus is remarkably better than it was in the past. So that's great. You know, anything to improve the autofocus is always a good thing. Stabilization issues, especially with specific lenses that were improved. So a lot of bug fixes in there. And then some new features like the GX9. I know a camera that you're familiar with has a new monochrome mode, monochrome D, with a film simulation mode in it, kind of a film grade simulator.
Yeah,
to have that.
It reminds me of a lot of what you would get through a film processing software like Nick Silver FX or something that has a really nice high contrast, kind of glossy finish to it.
There you go. So that mode has now been added to all three of these cameras, that camera profile, I should say. So that's great. So if you like that, and I love that sort of thing, I love shooting black and white, and I love the look of a real film grain. And so I've only done a little bit of cursory shots with it so far, but so far what I've seen is beautiful. And you have the GX9. Do you shoot it with that mode often?
No, I'm typically more of a color guy. I love saturated colors for the most of the macro work that I do. But if I'm doing landscape or street photography, sometimes it's really valuable to see in black and white when you're shooting. And I remember famously, was it Ansel Adams would use like an orange filter to kind of obfuscate color just when he was looking through to see things more monochromatically. But now through our, you know, electronic viewfinders, you know, as the topic of discussion today, you can be shooting in a monochrome mode, whichever you choose, and be shooting raw. So the embedded JPEG in the raw file will show you exactly what that monochrome profile looks like. And depending on which software you process that with, of course, can recognize that exact profile and duplicate that for the raw data, or you can choose to reprocess it. I'm assuming if you say, okay, you know what, I love 90% of what I was shooting in black and white this day, but this one color shot just needs to be processed that way. And all the information is still there in the file.
Well, that's why when shooting those kind of profile modes, I always say, and I always recommend that you shoot raw plus JPEG. So you get both. You get that JPEG that is looking as the camera designed it to, you know, with that profile, that grain pattern, whatever embedded in it. But then you have the raw file, which, as you say, is always going to be color. But if you only wanted to shoot, if you only wanted to see black and white simply for the sake of composition and not actually get a black and white file out of it, I don't know about your camera, but I know the higher end Lumix cameras at least do have a grayscale, a black and white viewfinder mode where the viewfinder is black and white. The image is still color. It's not shooting a black and white JPEG. It's just that what you're seeing through the viewfinder is now black and white. That's pretty cool.
Yeah, and that makes me more envious of the electronic viewfinders. Again, that tech is increasing in performance and usability, so I'm excited to see that. Any other little gems of
there's a lot of little things. So I actually did a huge, it was turned into almost a 45-minute long show on my channel yesterday, so that's now published, so people can see that.
And, we'll put a link to that.
Every single step. I'm sorry?
We'll put a link to that for sure.
Awesome. Thank you. You can see every single feature in there step by step. And I go through and I demonstrate the ones that are able to be demonstrated. But I'll just grab a few that kind of caught my attention. There's one that this is kind of funny because I had no idea what the purpose of this was until I actually tried it. And then went, oh, okay, I get it. There's a focus ring lock mode for when you're in manual focus that disables the focusing of the ring. And you're thinking, well, hold on a second, but I'm in manual, so I need the ring to focus the camera. What's the point of disabling it? And I realized it's so you can still focus the camera by touching the LCD.
Oh, okay.
So you can use the LCD to focus wherever you want it to focus on. What this does is it disables the focus ring so you can't accidentally knock it out of focus. So if you're in a focus lock situation, I think this is primarily going to be for video shooters, but you've got the camera on a tripod, your subject is in a fixed position, you focus on them, you don't want to risk bumping the camera out of focus, you can disable the focus ring. So now it doesn't do anything anymore. It's little things like that. I go, well, that's actually really clever.
Now, I would have to work in tandem with a feature that would prevent the focus from shifting when the camera turns off or goes to sleep. Because if I recall, and maybe there's a custom function that I just haven't figured out, but when the camera turns off, the focus, at least on the GX9, will return the lens to a set focus point.
Correct.
You would need, especially if you're doing this in like a studio setup where your focus is always going to be constant, but the camera might turn on or off, but you want to keep that specific point. Is there an ability on any of these cameras to set that, to stop it from resetting itself?
Yeah, there absolutely is. I'm not sure if it's on all the cameras or not, but there is a return to focus position. It might even be lens dependent as well. Right. Some lenses might be able to show that. I can't speak to that for sure, but I do know that that feature is in there, but that's not what this feature is for. This is specifically for I'm setting up a shoot. I want to focus on a position and not have a risk of that focus getting shifted. And so that's how you can lock it out.
And 95% of people are not going to care about that. But the 5%
that do.
Absolutely. It's a game changer.
Yeah, absolutely. There's a night mode. This is really cool. And actually, you might appreciate this. So there's a night mode that was in the GH5S and in the G9 that is now in the GH5 as well, where your viewfinder and or the LCD panel go red. Completely red. So it's just a monochromatic red image. And it's for when you're shooting at night so you don't blast out your night vision.
Oh, right.
It's really cool.
It could be very helpful. I mean, I've got a red flashlight for when I'm out in, there's a dark sky preserve near me. And they actually, it's a rule that you have to use a red light and nothing else, though not everybody follows it. if you're looking through an optical viewfinder, then it's not an issue. But an electronic viewfinder, it would blast your night vision.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So that's a really cool feature that's been now added to the GH5, was already in the other cameras. Let's see, other things. Upgrades to the power, to the wireless system a little bit. Other color profiles have been added, ability to program more functions into the function buttons. A few little things like that. It's overall, it's a really nice update.
Yeah.
Overall, really, it's, like I said, some bug fixes, some improvements, and a lot of it is just bringing feature parity across the flagship line.
Right. And moving forward, you know, that every future camera will have all of these fixes or implementations of features right. that people find particularly useful. And it's amazing that, yeah, you know, we're in 2018 right now, and mirrorless cameras and these companies have been around for quite a while, and they've been innovative every step of the way. There's still momentum there. It's not like we've reached a point where people are struggling to say, well, what are we going to add in next? And then all of the new features are just gimmicks.
No, right. There's a lot of room to grow. It's fun.
Yeah. Awesome. Now, talking about the industry and how it's been evolving, I came across a story on Petapixel that, you know, kind of made me chuckle because the title is People Magazine Once Paid $10,000 for a Photo It Didn't Want. And okay, you know, I love reading this stuff about the industry and how it works in certain ways, but this was at the beginning of what defined paparazzi. And, you know, these kinds of payouts caused a frenzy of photographers or wannabe photographers to try and get that critical celebrity photograph that would then be ultimately licensable for a very high amount of money. And I was surprised at how much People Magazine was paying because they were spending tens of thousands of dollars every single week to license exclusive celebrity photos from photographers. And that's a lot of money compared to what, you know, paid for photographers that were commissioned to shoot for other organizations. Yeah, they were able to pay their bills, but they were not getting rich on any of this stuff. If you wanted to sort of win the lottery as a photographer, you would get that paparazzi picture. And there were a lot of people that were after that. But at some point, they were just spending money left and right, that they were buying images so that they could have exclusive rights so that nobody else could have them. And I just found that hilarious. Did you know this about the industry specifically, that they were just trying to keep it away from their competition?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. The amount of money that you're talking about that was going around in this era was just appalling. And it drove this ridiculous industry, like you said, of the paparazzi, that was so offensive and so horrible to have happen. And the only reason they're doing this is because they're getting paid ridiculous amounts of money. So on the one hand, the celebrities are pissed off at the paparazzi, but the only reason they're doing it is because magazines like People Magazine were paying them. If that economy didn't exist, or the magazine said, you know what, we're not playing this game, this is ridiculous, then that wouldn't have happened. But of course, you know, they're all in the business to make money. The magazine's got to make money and answer to their shareholders, and you got to do what sells. It was unfortunate, but I think that that's largely fallen to the wayside.
Well, I mean, you look at People Magazine, Time Magazine, a lot of the big publications, they're not quite as profitable as they once were. And in fact, you see today's economy where, you know, if something is posted to social media, then a lot of these magazines will just embed that Instagram post because that's part of the end user license agreement that says you can do that and there's no compensation required for their online content. And so that all of this stuff ends up having sort of a zero sum associated with it to use content these days. And yes, you know, if you don't allow that and people use your images anyhow, then there's copyright infringements. And I've got a lot of those cases ongoing right now with companies that have stolen my work. And it's unfortunate that you have to go after it in that way. But I also get people that contact me and they ask me very specifically to use my images for editorial content or for promotional content. I got an email just today from a religious organization that's doing something up in Alaska. And they asked for permission to use one of my images. And, you know, they didn't say, you know, can we license it? You know, well, what would it cost? I know that they want to use it for free. And I get a lot of requests for that these days, not just from independent, you know, small charity organizations or religious organizations. I get those. But sometimes it's from bigger people that kind of surprise me a little bit. And I just wanted to opine on this for a little bit. I was contacted by PPA, the Professional Photographers of America, recently to have one of my images published and talked about in their Professional Photographer magazine. And when I asked, you know, what the compensation was, their response was absolutely nothing. You know, we won't pay you for the image. We'll give you exposure, and that should be prestigious enough for you. And I always hate that argument that, we'll give you exposure for your
work. I told that at the gas station when I'm filling them up. I'm like, I'll tell everybody I filled up a Chevron, but you just got to fill my tank for free.
Exactly. And yeah, you know what? It doesn't cost me anything to let you use the image for free, except that if I do that, then I will never be able to license my images for a price to pay the bills and, you know, pay my mortgage. So, you know, when I ask them, you know, if there's any alternative, even I'm not a member of PPA. And so this was kind of a bit of an aside too. It's one thing if I'm a member of your organization and you put out an all call for submissions for content and the details are outlined and I'm aware of what I'm getting into and I want to contribute. It's another thing when you're cold calling photographers that have no association with your organization and you're asking for something from them for free. So NANPA did this for me. They asked me to do a webinar for them on macro photography, and they wouldn't pay me for it, but they gave me a one-year NANPA subscription, the North American Nature Photographers Association.
Okay.
And that was a fine deal. You know, I got to be involved in NANPA and to be a part of that organization. So I figured, you know what, PPA, let's just do the same deal. Will you give me an honorarium here as a complimentary membership into the organization for 1 year? And they basically said no. We can't make any exceptions to this rule. And you know, if you're not happy with letting us use your image for free, then that's the end of this conversation.
So what is the logic of a company like that asking photographers? It's a Professional Photographers Association, right? That is what the PPA stands for, right? Okay, just making sure. What is the logic in asking professional photographers to basically drop the professional part of their title and give them the work for free? How does that make sense?
Exactly. Oh, and they say that they're a nonprofit. And as I understand nonprofits, you have to make zero income at the end of the year, right? You know,
but this person emailing you is probably drawing a salary.
They might be a volunteer. I'm not sure. I didn't get any confirmation of that. But they take hundreds of dollars for a membership on a yearly basis from anybody that wants to be a member in PPA. In their Professional Photographer magazine, they sell advertising. I mean, there are a lot of ways for them to make money from this organization. And yes, I understand that goes into to pay lobbyists and to change copyright laws that benefit photographers and to fight for photographers' rights. And there's a lot of good things that they can do with that money. But one of those good things they can do is pay the photographers that write for their magazines. They pay photographers that do presentations for them. And that's great. And I'm glad that they do that. PPOC, the Canadian version of this organization, the Professional Photographers of Canada, I have been a member, although I did not renew this year because I'm seeing that it's not as useful for me. But I wrote a magazine article for them, and they gave me service merit points that I could put towards a future designation if I got enough of those within the organization. And when I did a presentation for them, they also paid me for that too. So there is money being funneled back into photographers, or at least something given back in a general sense, but not with Professional Photographer magazines. So I just wanted to make my opinion known on that, and I hope you agree that it just seems wrong.
It does seem wrong. It's their response to you saying that, well, we're a nonprofit. I feel like, okay, that's nice, but I'm not.
Yeah, and neither is any professional photographer.
Right. We're not a nonprofit. My goal is not to end up with $0 in the bank at the end of the year. I need to pay bills. And even the nonprofit pays bills. They pay for the magazine printing, they pay their employees, they pay tons of things, they pay, you know, all the different things that they have to pay for, but yet they want to have $0 in the bank at the end. Fine, well, put me on that list, put professional photographers who you're asking for content for your magazine.
And you don't have to pay me a lot. You can pay me $100. I mean, so long as it's something and not zero. Right. And it can be, you know, a very tricky way to go from zero to a penny. right? As soon as you start paying people out, then you have to have the infrastructure for making those payments and what have you. But you're already doing that with other areas of your business.
Yeah, exactly.
So
exactly. I don't see the purpose of that. And I think it just goes to hurt the industry because it really goes to, it shows professional photographers that, oh, you should be charging people money, just not us.
Yeah. Yeah. And at the same time, you know, if National Geographic approached me and said, Don, we want to use one of your images on the cover of Nat Geo and we're not going to pay you, it's about the only time I'm going to say yes.
You'd probably say yes.
And I'm only going to say it once. You know, if they come to me again for the next issue, that's, well, okay. You know, as much as I love that publicity, really, you should be paying me.
Yeah. Yeah, there are, right, and there are, and that's worth mentioning as well. When it comes to working for free, in general, we want to say no. We want to tell people that you should always say no, but there are times where it's worth saying yes because the exposure truly is beneficial. Simply to be able to say, I was on the cover, my photo is on the cover of Nat Geo, that's kind of a big deal. That's kind of a big deal. And not like, you know, one of the little subsidiary National Geographic kids, not one of the, you know, online public, like the actual National Geographic. Yeah, okay. You could have that for free because that would be enormously huge for me. But if you're not that level, it just, I don't, it's, yeah, pay me.
It's really hard to justify that exposure moniker. And I've had debates with people all the time about this. There was a small, I think it was a jewelry designer that was doing an exhibition somewhere on the West Coast. And they wanted to use one of my images in their catalog just to illustrate some of the beauty of nature that has inspired some of their work. And and I gave them a response that basically said, well, as a fellow artist and one that makes a living at this, I'm sure you can appreciate that I license my work for a fee. I gave them a reasonable fee. They paid it within an hour and they had the full resolution image. And that's exactly how it should happen. A mutual respect across that. Unfortunately, that's a rarity. That is the exception to the rule these days.
Yeah. 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 Well, good for you for sticking to your guns.
Well, yeah. And it probably means PPA is not going to publish that photograph. And that's fine. I get a fun story out of it no matter what.
Well, hopefully they're not going to publish it since they haven't paid you. If they do, then you will get paid, won't you?
If they do, I will get paid a tidy sum, I'm sure.
Yeah.
All right. Now let's move into the final story. This is just a fun one. This to me just shows that there are fools in every aspect of society. Again, this was a Petapixel article that shows a man climbing a NASCAR fence for photos of race cars, looking like with a cell phone or something similar. It's not even with a proper camera. And when we're talking a fence, this reminds me of those fences that guard a medium security prison. Like they kind of have this arching, not really barbed wire in this case, but it's not a short little fence. And and it looks like it's a fairly unsafe place to be at this kind of overhanging fence post. And so this guy just climbs up to get photos of the cars going by. And all the spectators are, you know, videoing this idiot that's doing it. And he gets pulled down by the seat of his pants and escorted out, says never to return. That pretty much sums it up. I mean, we don't really need to discuss that too much. But there are a lot of idiotic things that photographers have done. There's people that will scale tall buildings for photographs of them at the very top of them without any safety gear. And I've heard so many tragic stories of people that have fallen off to their death.
Oh, really?
And, you know, and some of them are even caught on video from some of their behind the scenes cameras. And it's just tragic. It's awful. But as a photographer, I think every one of us are willing to take certain risks in our work. Maybe they're not something that will, you know, risk our bodily safety, but maybe it's, you know, something that, you know, risks you being unpopular or something that is controversial in your work. So, Joseph, you like to push certain limits with the kind of work that you do as well. Is there anything that you've done that you would consider was risky to yourself or to your artistic integrity?
I'll answer that in two parts because you did ask me this question yesterday. I thought about what story I was going to tell you, but now that you expanded your question a little bit, I'll say that one area of risk, and it's not like any huge risk by any means, but street photography, right? It's not easy to put your camera into people's faces to get that picture that you want. There is a certain amount of personal, there's safety, sure, but more of just, I don't want people to look funny at me. I don't want people to get mad at me. How can I get this picture that I really want to create and feel okay with it? And that's something that can take a lot to overcome. And as you undoubtedly know, street photography, at least here in the United States, is perfectly legal. You can go out and shoot if people are in public. You're not breaking any laws. So you have the right to do it, but it still can be very uncomfortable. And so getting past that comfort level is not always an easy thing to do. And I struggle with it myself sometimes, especially if you're in a culture where you're not so sure. You know, you maybe know it's legal, but you're not so sure whether, how are people going to react? You know,
it's outside my comfort zone too. And I actually took a photographic workshop on that exact topic to help me overcome some of my own insecurities in that area. Chris Marquardt was the host of that workshop in Toronto. Okay. That was back in 2010, I think. And I was already a professional photographer at the time, but there's no reason why pros can't take workshops in areas outside of their expertise and continually grow.
Do it all the time.
And it was so much fun. It was liberating. I haven't done a lot of street photography since, but if I were to go onto the streets of Toronto or any other big city nearby, I would feel comfortable doing street photography. And I do that on photo walks now with zero regard for if people care that I'm taking their picture.
Right.
You know,
and that takes a lot to get
it
to.
It does.
So there's that part of it. The personal story I was going to tell of kind of the riskiest, and it's, you know, not that risky by any means, but there is a photo that I really like that I did when I was on a social media campaign for Mercedes. This is quite a few years ago. And we had I wanted to do a picture of this one car, this SLS. It has kind of these gold wing doors. I wanted to shoot it top down. We were down in LA and I have a friend down there who shoots a lot in the area. And I asked him if there's anywhere that we could go where I could shoot top down on it. He had the perfect spot. And there's some overpass in downtown LA where there's quite literally a hole, and not like a pothole kind of hole, but, you know, a constructed hole in the middle of the road to see the road underneath it. And it's not the kind of thing you just lean over and look down, because it's a really, really thick piece of concrete. And when you go over that edge, there is a platform there. So anything that falls over doesn't fall into the cars below. Well, so naturally I climbed over that. And even there, I couldn't hold the camera out far enough in front of me. And I know people aren't seeing this on video, so it's hard to visualize. But if you imagine standing on the edge of a cliff and you hold the camera out in front of you to shoot something that's 20 feet down below, if that cliff is thick, you're only going to see the cliff. You have to get the camera pretty far out to get away from that edge.
And you're shifting your center of gravity slowly and slowly further out until you hit that tipping point.
And then you fall down. So that's a bad idea. So naturally, I did it. And one of the things I was able to use is actually one of the this is part of my story of switching to mirrorless, but it was one of the first commercial jobs. It was the first commercial job I did with mirrorless cameras. And having that flip-up LCD was a huge advantage in this. So I could hold the camera out in front of me without having to have my eye over it and still see it. But then I had a backpack on that I cinched up really tight and had someone behind me hold onto the backpack and someone holding onto them. So we had a chain of people so I could lean way past the comfort level to get the shot. And we did. I got the shot. It's a brilliant photo. I absolutely love it. But a little risky.
Yeah, you know, I've leaned out of a helicopter to get a fisheye view of the Toronto Harbor front, and for a fisheye view, the camera has to be completely removed from the chassis of the aircraft for the aircraft to be removed from the edges of the frame.
Fair enough.
So, you know, I was leaning out as far as I could. I was in a harness, of course, so it wasn't that risky. I wasn't worried about hitting that tipping point. But you know, I don't usually have straps on my camera, so you know, you put the camera out as far as you can, just don't drop the camera. But probably the riskiest thing that I've done, and in hindsight, maybe not that risky, but my wife is originally from Bulgaria, and we typically, once a year, this year it's going to be in August, we go back there and visit with family and friends. We'll rent a car for a couple of days and explore the countryside. Well, there's one of the most beautifully destroyed buildings in Bulgaria. It's called Buzulja, which is equally impossible to spell. And it is the former Communist Party headquarters of the during the era of the Soviet Union, when the Communist Party was in power. And it sits atop Mount Buzulja in the Balkan Mountains. And there's not a whole lot around. There's a small town or two. But it looks like this giant UFO that is sitting on this rooftop. And the first time that we were there, somebody had cut some metal welds on some secondary doors and punched a hole in some wooden doors inside. You could crawl through that hole. And we did. And it was the most beautifully destroyed building that we had ever seen in our lives. If you talk about urban exploration, this is one of those mecca locations of urban exploration, because it is just so beautiful in its decay. And so the second time we went, actually on our honeymoon, my wife and I, they had fixed the hole in the door and we couldn't get in that way. But somebody at the time was spray painting enjoy communism in the font of enjoy Coca-Cola on the front of the building. So we figured if anybody knows how to get in, it's him. And he showed us how to climb through a hole between two levels of stairs on the side of the building. And we went back inside. We met more English speaking people inside that building in one place than we saw anywhere else in the country, because it was something of a tourist destination of sorts. But we were talking to one guy from New Zealand who had two girls with him from Britain, and they were staying at a nearby hostel. And so we chatted with them for a bit, and they carried on their way, and they said, we're just going to go up the tower. Well, there's a giant tower associated with this building as well. It's like solid concrete until you get to a red communist star at the top. And I didn't know you could get up there. And so I asked him, how easy is it to get up there? It's like, it's simple. And well, I said, how safe? Well, just don't fall. Okay, fair enough. And so we climb up this this staircase that is basically like a concrete coffin. There's no windows or anything. We have lights on our phones or flashlights, and we're making our way up this this rusted out staircase until we get to the top. And it is just so beautiful up there. As a symbol of the fall of communism, this place is just wonderful because you've got this natural landscape surrounding it, and it's falling apart and nobody's going to fix it. It's probably much less safe now. This was a few years ago. Mm-hmm. But when I was at the top of the building, I wanted to do something much like you had said, Joseph, where you wanted to have the camera beyond the edge to see the landscape, but also see the structure and everything else. Mm-hmm. So I did something foolish. I mean, foolish for my camera gear anyhow. I put my camera on a travel tripod, which is normally sturdy when used properly, but this is a 1DX camera body. And I'm fishing this tripod out, legs fully extended, but connected together like a little bundle. So this is just like a long pole that I'm fishing out horizontally off of the structure. And I could see the tripod noticeably bending as I get far enough out to get a proper composition. And it ended up working out perfectly fine as a fisheye panorama, no less. I had to do it multiple times at different angles to get the shot that I was after. And it worked, and it was worth it. If I had dropped my camera, it most certainly would not have been.
Not have been worth it. Well, I've Googled this. I've figured out the spelling. I'm looking at it. This is incredible. What a building.
Wow. Yeah, I'll put a photo to that in the show notes there so that everybody can see it. Some of the ones from our little adventure there. And I did some video inside that building too. I'll see if I can dig it up. But cool. I've heard from some of the urban explorers that it's now pretty well impossible to get in.
Oh, really?
Unless you scale the entire building and rappel down through the roof, which I wouldn't do. But who knows? Maybe somebody else has found another hole to
might be worth it. This thing looks so cool.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah, and if you do find yourself in that way, the authorities probably can't get to you. It is a really fun building, and I want to do more urban exploration, but there is some significant risks involved in that. So you always have to weigh the pros and the cons. And a fairly notable urban explorer photographer, Sean Galbraith, who is based out of Toronto, him and I have gone on a couple of excursions to a variety of different places. And it's always fun to discover what you can find in an old slaughterhouse or an abandoned high school. It doesn't have to be quite as prestigious or glorious as something like that. It's just a different aspect of photography that does have associated risks, because you never know if you're going to be breathing in asbestos or... Sean famously told me one story where he broke into an abandoned building. I forget exactly what it was, but at the time it was being used by our provincial police force to train their police dogs.
Oh, geez.
And they were there and they sniffed him out while he was. maybe I should have him on and we can do a fun episode about that kind of stuff. You never know what you're going to encounter with that. Yeah. And I haven't had anything quite so dire, but it's those risks, they do have rewards. I just would never scale a fence like the one depicted to take cell phone photographs at a NASCAR race. That just seems a little bit foolish beyond foolishness.
Just a little bit.
Just a little bit. All right, let's go into the final bit here, the picks of the week. And I've got something that I recommend to my macro photography students when they take a workshop, somewhat in jest in an email that I send out. You know, bring a Pringles can along, because it actually works as a brilliant light modifier. Mm-hmm. one of the issues with macro photography is if you're using on-camera flash, you'll get harsh shadows on your subject, or the lighting doesn't connect to the subject in the right way. For example, with water droplet refraction photography that I do a lot of workshops on, the light has to hit the background stronger than the foreground. And that makes the background brighter, refracting through the water droplet, making it glow brighter than the surface that it's attached to. And okay. That's part of the magic of how those images work. And a Pringles can is the perfect light modifier to do that when you have on-camera flash, whether it's a speed light that you don't have a cord or wireless triggers for, or just an on-camera flash. You can cut a hole either to mount it properly on the flash side of things or just tape it in place. Either way works. And the other end, I cut them off on about a 45 degree angle, but you can do it straight as well. And then you just cover that opening with wax paper or a coffee filter or just something to diffuse the light. And that effectively changes the light source location from on top of the camera to wherever that opening is. And it can be a dramatic difference. I've got a magazine cover shot that was shot putting the earth inside of a water droplet. It was on the cover of Outdoor Photography Canada magazine. And it was shot using a Pringles can as the light modifier. And it worked wonderfully. It almost worked better than having my flash in that position with a diffuser because it was easier to handle. So a Pringles can as a flash modifier. I think, Joseph, you actually wrote an article on this and how to do it. And you had sample photographs as well. I didn't even know you had done that when I made this.
That's
my
so
pick.
Funny. That's funny. Yeah. You sent that to me and I thought, I did an article on that a while ago. I pulled that up. It's too funny. It's a great tip. It absolutely is. Yeah, it's a lot of fun. And it's especially a great way. I mean, the way you're taking it is way beyond what I did with it, but to simply be able to do macro photography, close-up photography with a flash when all you have is your on-camera flash, it makes it possible.
Well, you and can it get makes that it close-up inventive. Of the flower. And inventiveness in photography inspires creativity immediately. And a lot of times when you go to the store, the camera store, and you look for something off the shelf that's going to do what you want, there's nothing creative about that. Somebody else has done all of the legwork for you. But when you start to design something yourself, even if it's as simple as a Pringles can, you'll start to get new ideas as to how you might improve that or use a similar technique with something different. And it gets that that inventive kind of engineering side of photography churning a little bit inside of you. And that inventiveness will inspire you to take it further and in different directions and find your own your creative style. I think I've developed a lot of my own creative style as soon as I start to tinker and be creative and ask what if. And this is one of those moments where photographers can kind of dip their toes in the water to that end.
Absolutely. I love the DIY-ness of anything like that. Just it allows you, as you said, to come up with a different way of doing something. If you buy it off the shelf, then it was designed to do something in a particular way. And sure, you might be able to modify that, tweak it, whatever. But when you truly get into the DIY side of things, that's when it gets really fun.
Exactly. Well, your pick of the week, you've told me beforehand, but I do want to preface it with a story here. You know, I clean camera sensors, not as a primary source of my business, but if a student wants me to do that, they're coming for a workshop, they can show up early, or some of the local photography club members have used me in the past, and I don't mind it. I've got all the gear here to do it. As a complimentary service to that, I just check and see if their firmware is up to date on their camera. And 9 times out of 10, it is so sorely out of date that they've either never updated it or the update is maybe 3 years old that I'm going to be applying to their camera. And so you can take it from there.
Okay. I was kind of wondering where you're going with this sensor cleaning. I'm thinking, did he think I was, did I put the wrong thing in the notes of what? No. The firmware update. So we talked about it earlier in the show. Absolutely. But yeah, the new Lumix update for the GH5, GH5S and G9. If you go to, I built a shortcut on my site. If you just go to photojoseph.com/Lumix update, it'll take you to the update page, makes it really easy so you can find it and download it. And it's actually a really, really easy process. If you read every letter of the website, it'll make it sound like you need a doctorate to get this thing done.
All you do, and I'm going to assume it's the same as every other manufacturer, is put the firmware file on your memory card and then go to the firmware button in the camera and it'll ask you if it wants to update, right?
It's actually even easier than that. You put the firmware update onto the card, turn on the camera and hit play.
Oh.
You just hit play and it pops it. It goes to play because at that point it's reading from the memory card. It's looking for a photo, but it finds this .bin file and it goes, oh, do you want to up the, I think it says, do you want to up the camera or something like that? It doesn't say upgrade. Do you want to up the camera? You go, yes, I do.
Up away.
Up yours. Thank you. And up mine and up theirs. And there you go. And off it goes. So it's super easy to do. Absolutely worth it. Fixes, like we said earlier, some bugs and adds some new features. But because that's a free update, and your Pringles can is, you know, all of $1.99 or whatever it costs to buy a Pringles can. I am going to throw, I'm going to take advantage of this and throw in my workshop as my other pick of the week. It's a little bit more expensive than free or $2, but it is, I think, a very reasonable price for what it is. So again, that's the India workshop.
How much does it cost?
So interestingly, I set it up with a sliding scale. The maximum price it could possibly be is a little under $6,000. Mm-hmm. And that is if I have the minimum number of people sign up and you don't pay in full by the early date, which is actually June 15th. So it's not that far away. If you pay in full by June 15th, then you get a 10% discount. So that's straight off. As we add more people, the price drops for everybody. So if we get a maximum of 8 people, it drops almost $1,000 in price for everybody.
That's
so if you pay in full,
because that means that if you want to sign up for this workshop, you are incentivized to bring a friend.
Exactly. And share it, tell everybody about it, try and get somebody else to go. And yeah, every person that gets added, the price drops a little bit. And if you pay in full in advance and the price ends up going down, you'll just, you know, send you $1,000 back or whatever it is.
Yeah. And, you know, to go to any location that is, you know, on a different continent, there's going to be huge costs associated with that, whether or not you're on a photo tour or not. If you're just on a tour to Iceland and it's not a photo tour, you're going to pay like maybe about that number. And you're not going to have a master instructor like you, Joseph, that is orchestrating and knowing exactly where the narratives are going to take place and to help you capture that magic yourself.
Absolutely. And just so that people know too, what is included in that price, it's not just me that you're paying for. That basically covers everything from the moment you get off the plane. You do have to get yourself to India, of course, but once you get off the plane, all ground transportation, all hotels, all meals are covered by this cost. So unless you know, short of buying souvenirs, that's about the only thing you'll need to spend money on.
That's awesome. That doesn't happen a lot of the time, actually. So I'm glad you do it that way.
And when we first started putting it together, it didn't include meals. I was like, you know, I want it to be all inclusive. To me, it just makes it easier. Because if I'm going to spend that kind of money on a workshop, I want to know exactly how much I'm actually spending. And I want to get there and find out, well, I had to spend another $1,000 on food. I wasn't expecting that. And so this way we've made it so that it's all included, all inclusive. Right.
And you can find that at photojoseph.com/India, correct?
There you go. That's the one.
And photojoseph.com is where you can find pretty much all of your work and your YouTube channel, which is?
YouTube.com/photojoseph.
And you do, how many times a week do you do your show?
3 times a week, Monday, Wednesday, Friday, 9:30 a.m. Pacific time. It's a live show. And that's part of the fun of it. We're live. If you can watch it live, you can participate in the show and ask questions, and I'll answer them in real time. And it's a really fun way to go through photography techniques, gear, you know, new announcements, whatever it might be.
And we did an episode of that. I was a guest a little while back,
right.
And I think it was a pretty good discussion. And so I'm going to find the link to that, or maybe you can dig it up a little bit faster than I can, and I'll put it in the show notes for people to check out.
Absolutely. Yeah, that was great. Every once in a while, we have guests on. It's always fun to do that.
Perfect. Well, I think that rounds us out. You can find my work at doncom.ca, and you'll see all of the technology musings that I have pushing photography to new limits. I'm doing a lot of ultraviolet work right now on all of my social media links, and they're all there. For the show notes for this episode, you can find them at photogeekweekly.com, as well as our back catalog of all of our wonderful 28 previous episodes of this show, and the Inside the Lens periodic podcast, where we dive deep into specific topics. Those are always a good listen as well. If you've gotten to this point in the episode and you're still hanging on, well, then you've done enough listening for now. It's time to get out and shoot.